Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all back with us here. This is our time of the week for Soundbites, our weekly look at what's going on in our food system from many different angles and ideas. I want to remind you on the way here, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com. And Soundbites is a production here, WEAA-FM in Baltimore, Maryland, 88.9, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, where you hear this program, Soundbites, every Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM, and at 6 p.m. on WSCL 89.5 FM. The partnership of two very interesting and different public radio stations to bring you Soundbites here on The Mark Steiner Show. And we this hour, we're going to be talking about a number of things. We're going to be talking to John Echeverra later on the program about a decision by the Supreme Court we didn't follow very much, but changes the nature of land use in America that we'll be talking about. We're also talking about the shrimp you love to eat and the slave labor behind the shrimp you love to eat. And a interesting recording done by my producers on the Baltimore Farm Alliance. We'll hear at the end of the program. But right now, we are joined in studio. It's been a while since he's been on Soundbites. It's great to have him back. Michael Twitty. Michael Twitty is a culinary historian of African and African-American foodways and more. He's a blogger at Afroculinaria, which is his site. And his open letter to Paula Deen went viral. He wrote it. The country picked it up, went on national public radio and everywhere else, and everybody wants to talk to him. Thank God we knew him first. Michael Twitty, good to have you on the program.
Well, pardon my throat and clearing and all that kind of good stuff. The weather's been weird, but thank you, Mark. I really appreciate being back here.
410-319-8888 is the number. Rachel's here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. So, Michael, let's start with this. I mean, you've done some really fascinating work gathering the Southern cultures together, crossing this Afro-Jewish world through music, through food and more. But this letter to Paula Deen, talk about, I was going to have you read the entire letter, but we might be here all day because it's a long letter.
it's a long letter.
But talk to us about why you, as a Southern man, as you put it, had to write this letter to a Southern woman.
Well, I feel like my mother always taught me, say what you mean and mean what you say. And once you say it, you ain't got to say anymore. I've had some time to reflect on the nature of the letter. People should, you know, I'll start with the negatives because the positives have been so voluminous.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And people got on me about typos and little piddling things. I mean, you know, most bloggers will tell you, when something's big, they want to jump on it so people will read their blog. They want to get it done. They don't fine-tooth comb it. And they try to publish whatever the hot topic is at times when people will read it at work and will forward it. Personally, I never thought that more than 10 people would say, okay, I like it, I don't like it. Okay, back to business. And I didn't do it for any other reason than the fact that if anybody should be commenting on this issue, it should be those of us who work with Southern food who are the least of these, the least represented. So I wanted to really sort of engage her in a dialogue and say, okay, this is a mess. And it's a family matter because as people who are beneath the Mason-Dixon line, it's a falsehood that we have some sort of Jim Crow line of opinion. Whatever happens to them happens to us and vice versa. And until we stop pretending that anything else is true, nothing will change. So I really wanted to make sure that people understood, no, this is a family matter. We're going to have to deal with it. Deal with it as a nation, as a people, as peoples, as a family of Southerners. So that's why.
But one of the things you said as you talked to her, I mean, some of it was tongue-in-cheek. But you really, when you write things like, you have wonderful things in here. You and I are both human. We are both Americans. We are both quite healthily built.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, none of these labels is more profound for me than the fact we are both Southern. Sweet tea runs in our blood. In fact, is our blood. what I understand to be true, a lot of your critics don't, which is, as Southerners, our ancestors co-created the food and hospitality and manners which you were born to 68 years ago, and I, 36. And you want me to read this last sentence you wrote, this paragraph, and we'll jump off from that. In the words of a scholar, Michal Sobel, this was a world they made together, and beyond that, it would be a world we make together. So I speak to you as a fellow Southerner, a cousin, if you will, not as a combatant.
Yeah.
Now, most people, this was all over the place. People got very upset, and folks, join us with your thoughts on Paula Deen, and you hear what Michael Twitty says on his thoughts, 410-319-8888. When she used the N-word, people, it was reported to have used the N-word.
Right.
That's what set this off.
Yep.
And then other things came tumbling out. And the world was really mixed about this. And you saw a lot of healthily built white people lining up at a restaurant mm-hmm. to go and have some food.
Kind of like Chick-fil-A.
Right? Mm-hmm. to support this. So, I mean.
Okay, so, you know, one of the. I've been pestered a lot about the other allegations and that have been, you know, made against her and her company and her brother and her husband, and this kind of outrage about that. But I got to tell you something. So this whole N-word thing, you ask most black folks my parents' age, and they'll tell you right quick, this doesn't shock us. This is no big surprise. This woman grew up in Georgia 60-some years ago. You know, what was? But also, I think some of the allegations, they're very serious. They're disturbing. They're painful. But you know something? They're also a part of our history. You can't, you know, James Baldwin talked about, you can't just talk about the history, you talk about the system of mind behind the history. You know, my grandmother would never be a domestic. You know why? Because domestics got raped. Domestics got sexually abused. And she did not, she would kill somebody if they tried that with her. So I have to pause and tell people, you know, on the blog, my blog's in a courtroom. And these allegations are very serious. And I'm not a lawyer. I want to talk about what the major media hype is about, and then all focused on Paula Deen saying the N-word. And it's a stereotype. She's, you know, they've made her into some kind of redneck hillbilly queen who makes you fat with butter and lard. Of course, she slathers everything with this word. And I think that's not fair. It's not fair because the relationship between cultures and people in the South is much more complex than that, much more complex. You know, it's kind of like when you hear some of the folks from, you know, my father's generation talk about, you know, these kind of the Dixiecrats. So what the game they would play is this. In front of the cameras, they had an axe. In front of the cameras, they had this, you know, vitriol they would spew. But behind the scenes, they were very different people. They were wheeling and dealing. It doesn't mean they were nice. It doesn't excuse the racist behavior that actually spurred other people into violence and lawlessness. But it's more complex than just someone is, you know, a figurehead for that kind of behavior. And, you know, I, like I said, it's my blog's in a courtroom. I decided to go with the aspect that the hype was about. People keep trying to post the deposition. I let them do it. But I had a personal attack the other night ago, and I said, "Oh, this is not cool," because you don't come on my blog
attacking you.
Oh yeah, for not holding her responsible for all the allegations in the deposition,
from the pornography to the N-word to uh-huh. having people dress up as slaves who yeah. worked in a restaurant.
And that's why I brought up the issue of the plantation. I mean, I really want people to understand this. When you are a black interpreter, a living history interpreter, as I do. You portray a cook, and you own that. You have to deal with all these legacies of slavery every time you walk into a different historic plantation or house, no matter what part of the country it's in. It's always there. And so this idea of dressing up as enslaved people doesn't surprise me, because we have a culture where people go into these big mansions, house plantations, and all they see is opulence and wealth. They see a fantasy of black subservience. And it's not just her. It's not just her. There's a whole industry in the South built on that. So don't just interrogate her. Interrogate the industry.
Now, talk about industry for a moment. The industry of food. One of the things you said, what you're mad at, is I'm not mad at you, as you said in this piece, for using the N-word. That's not what I'm getting upset at. You're upset about who's been cut out of the. Let's just take the culinary history of the South.
Mm-hmm.
Who developed the food? What was the food that was developed? Who developed it? And who's been cut out of both on air being the chef and be given credit for where it comes from? And who cooked it? And who created it?
Right. I think one of the major problems is, even if you watch a lot of our cable networks that have food history programs, they relegate black people to this tertiary category when they were really the middlemen and middlewomen, which is to say that we talk a lot about Native American influences in Southern cuisine. People forget the fact that Native Americans in the South were displaced. They were killed off. They died from disease and they were enslaved. There weren't exactly cooking classes going on between the Native Americans and the Europeans, if you know what I mean. When someone has a musket in your face, you're not exactly trying to give them the recipe for cornbread. You know, I mean, that's just ridiculous. So, but one thing about enslaved Africans were they were maroons, they were runaways, they were freedom seekers. They were enslaved with Native Americans. They were slaves to Native Americans. And they were married to Native Americans. And so a lot of these traditions that we consider just to be these Native Americanisms come through black Native American relations. But then you have the Europeans teaching their cooks Western foodways, which they introduced to black folks in the quarter. And then those folks introduce African foodways to the folks in the big house. And so as middlemen, as middlewomen, that's the real connection. And if you consider the fact, I mean, I've had people say to me, well, all white people in the South didn't own slaves. Okay, that's cool. So let's handle that for a second. Let's handle that for a second. This is important because I want people to know this. You didn't have to own enslaved people to be influenced by enslaved people. Not at all. And most yeoman farmers, if they could afford it, hired enslaved people from larger plantations. They worked and lived alongside black people all the time. So it is ridiculous to say that, oh, we didn't need you people kind of attitude, you know, that I've heard a lot. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. But yeah, it's very complex.
So, you write in here. Let me just read this other piece you wrote in, because I think it's important. Now, let's just jump into this for a moment. You write, gentrification in our cities, the lack of attention to southern food deserts often inhabited by the non-elites that aren't spoken of, the ignorance and ignoring the voices of a few token cooks, black cooks, chefs, or being called on to speak on our issues as an afterthought is what gets me mad. In the world of southern food, we are lacking diversity of voices, and that doesn't just mean black people or black perspectives. We are surrounded by culinary injustice, where some southerners take credit for things and that enslaved Africans and their descendants played key roles in innovating. Barbecue, in my lifetime, may go the way of blues and the banjo, a relic of our culture that wisps away. That tragedy rooted in the unwillingness to give African Americans, barbecue masters, and other cooks an equal chance on the platform is far more galling than when you use the N-word in childhood ignorance or emotional rage or social whimsy.
Mm-hmm. It sounds better when you read it.
Sounds better when you write it, though.
Well, I mean, yeah. So we had some folks get on my case about barbecue because there's a whole, you know, etymological argument. Where does the word come from? And is it from the Native Americans or the West Indies and blah, blah, blah? Okay, I'm not going to go into that. But I will say this much. Barbecue as a culture was definitely something that the Maroons of Jamaica and other West Indian islands, the Africans brought to North America, really took on and developed. So you only really see this whole, like, whole pig, whole chicken, red pepper sauce barbecue where black people are. But it's a Bubba thing now. And I ain't talking about her brother. I ain't talking about the restaurant neither. It's a Bubba thing.
Or Bill Clinton.
No, Bill Clinton. And it's really funny because I'm like, this is not, you know, it's being made into Bubba culture. And
right.
this gets very serious when it comes to barbecue competitions because guess what? You got to have, not only is the entry fees expensive, but the insurance. Because you're dealing with fire, sharp stuff. Heavy stuff.
Gas can blow up.
Yes. The insurance for these things is really, really prohibitive. And not only that, but, you know, some of the rules are don't parboil. You know why that's a little bit culturally insensitive? That's part of black barbecue tradition is some of us do par steam or parboil or par bake.
Right.
But they outlaw it. See, there's all kinds of ways to you know, do voter suppression. I'm sorry, barbecue suppression. in this vein, so I'm not fooled.
Mm-hmm. So, But that, to me, in some ways, is the heart of this. I mean, which you're kind of looking at Paula Deen and saying, along with this whole Southern cuisine industry and who controls even the down to the farming of what we farm and how we farm it, as becoming this kind of white corporate dominated world through the lens of kind of the sweet Southern drawl, and that's what you're kind of pushing against as much, if not more, than just Paula Deen herself.
Yeah, my job is to interrogate that brand, because that brand denies, supplants, suffocates the authentic culinary and cultural voice of people of color. Like I said, I've said to you this before. If you go to France and you get sparkling wine from any place but Champagne, it's just sparkling wine.
It ain't champagne.
Other cultures and other countries have affirmed the right to a certain amount of cultural ownership over certain foods, certain ingredients, certain, you know, traditional medicines. And yet African-Americans, we're just the servants. We're just the pass-through. And there's something really wrong about that with the people who desperately need every single form of uplift we can find. And this has been our uplift for generations. You know, Melissa Harris Perry pointed on her show a couple months ago that once upon a time, before you needed a degree to go cook, black cooks were, you know, we were, you know, 60-70% of the job. But when that came, you know, that came due, that came to be the new standard, we were supplanted. And, you know, people don't understand. It's really unfair to our people who have been a very deep part of the American food experience to sort of, you know, whisk us away to the corners of amnesia, cultural amnesia.
I mean, one of the things you're saying here, and I think it's important kind of to throw out, is that you talk about how sick you are. People talking about okra being
an African word. God almighty.
But talk about that in terms of why you're disgusted by that and what the kind of foods are that are important in that regard. And you end one of the paragraphs here, which I think is really connected to all that, where you say, we are a cleaver people at hiding our obsessions with downgrading the other.
We're clever people.
I said cleaver. I said clever. Sorry, clever. Well, cleaver.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't want any such with cleavers. You know, cleavers, machetes, Nat Turner. They're gonna get scared.
Denmark Vesey was murdered on this day. So
that's true. 1822.
That's right.
Here's the deal. I noticed something about the status quo when I first started to get professionally involved in this area of scholarship. As an independent scholar and as a culinary historian, as a living history interpreter, I noticed that a lot of people who were setting the rules about what could be studied and what could not be were ignorant. They didn't know. Okay, so they've been repeating someone else's writing. There's a lot of plagiarism out there, okay? So what I found out was these folks had taken no time to do any investigation into the African side of the story. They were happy just calling it African, and almost I could tell you exactly what all the books would say. Okra is an African word. Gumbo is an African word. So that's like me saying wheat is a European word. Apple is a European. That's really vague, isn't it? So the bottom line is that we're not looking, we're not asking a sort of a rigor, a respect. If you care about something enough, you will study it down to the nth degree. You'll look at ethnographic data. You look at historical data, primary sources. You will interview people who are living bearers of those traditions. You won't just say okra is an African word and thank you, Negroes, for the black eyed peas, the rice, and the watermelon, like every damn book says. You're going to go a step beyond that. And if it's my job to do that, because if you won't do it, then you know what? I deserve the same platform as these other folks do to tell my side of the story. And it's oftentimes not being told. And that is worthy of our anger, because that's culinary injustice in a nutshell.
And when you say, and I mentioned this kind of the cooking aspect and how this all fits into it, because that really is some of the rage that comes from some of this. And you're talking about where you're going to. That's it. You invited her to come to the historic Stagville, a North Carolina historical site, next September 7th. I want to be down there with you. I hope.
Awesome.
You say you want to, you write to her, I want you to walk the grounds with me. Go into the cabins. Most of all, I want you to help me cook. Everything is being prepared using locally sourced food, half of which we all hope come from North Carolina's African-American farmers who desperately need our support. Everything will be cooked according to 19th century methods on September 7, 2013. If you're brave enough, let's bake bread and break bread together at historic Stagville. This isn't publicity, it's opportunity. Leave the cameras at home. Don't worry, it's cool. Nobody will harm you if you're willing to walk with walk to the mourner's bench. Better yet, I'll be right there with you.
Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, I'm saying that everybody's flawed. You know what the mourner's bench is? You know, even though we're both Jewish. The mourner's bench is a black church reference to the space where the sinners go to you know, face up, cry out, you know, face their fears and their worries. And nobody in the human race is exempt from that mourner's bench. You know, in Jewish terms, they call it teshuva, which means to return, to answer, to respond. I don't think I'm above this woman at all. I sincerely will tell you that. I don't think I'm above anybody else. And I don't think fame makes you more apt or less apt to make mistakes. And I would really welcome them. I mean, Stagville is a fantastic place. We've had people wanting to come to this dinner regardless of whether she shows up or not. But this dinner is important because this is a plantation in North Carolina where 900 people were enslaved over a 200-year period. And 30,000 acres at one point. Tens of thousands of people come from the families that came from this plantation. And these sites desperately need our help in terms of, you know, staying up, keeping, you know, infrastructure. But also we want to make a point of, you know, buying a lot of the food from African-American farmers and supporting them and saying, we can use the present to correct the errors of the past. And I hope that she does come. Hope she joins us. If she doesn't, she doesn't. She does. She does. But the bottom line is we hope that in its own bubble that Stagville will be well supported that day and beyond, and that the Plantation Museum will continue to be a space of inspiration and reflection for people who want to know their past.
So what in the next few minutes we have left here in this segment, Michael Twitty, what should we learn from this Paula Deen incident, both as human beings, both as people who care about the future of our food and our food system?
Well, I mean, one of the aspects of Paula Deen's career that is, you know, previously controversial was the, you know, dedication and celebration of some certain unhealthier foods. And one of the traditions that I want to show her is that in our traditional Southern foodways before the Civil War, a lot of that food really wasn't that unhealthy. It was actually, you know, farm fresh food that, you know, was full of nutrients, that was cooked with a minimal amount of salt, grease, and other stuff. And that is the real traditional Southern food. And it's, you don't have to reinvent it to make it both healthy and tasty. I think that's a very odd idea. But I think it's also important for, you know, someone like her to shake hands with black men and women farmers, to shake hands with interpreters, to look in the eyes of people who are descendants, people who were sharecroppers who lived in the cabins up until the 1950s and 60s in Stagville. You get what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
I mean, this is a tremendous human opportunity. And for all of us, you know, all of us have our prejudices, all of us have our issues, but not all of us take the time to dialogue those issues out and tell the truth to one another. And that's where it all starts. That's where the healing really begins. And if we're willing to do that, then we're worthy of the July 4th we're about to celebrate. If not, then, you know, as Frederick Douglass put it, what to me is your 4th of July?
A speech everybody should read.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Frederick Douglass's July 4th speech. Michael Twitty is a culinary historian. You can go to afroculinaria.com. Is it org or com?
Com.
Com. That's A-Afro-C-U-L-I-N-A-R-I-A. And we'll also be linking to it on our website, steinershow.org, so you can read what Michael wrote. He'll be a guest on the show many times here on Soundbites and more. Michael, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, sir.
And you're listening to Soundbites here on WEAFM, the voice of the community in Baltimore, 88.9 FM, and on Delmarva Public Radio at WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. We'll be right back as we look at a Supreme Court decision you may not have heard about that affects our land. Then we'll talk about the slaves behind the shrimp you love to eat and hear a great pre-recorded story about the Baltimore Farmer Alliance. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites, our weekly look at the food system here on WEAFM 88.9 FM, the voice of the community and the voice of Delmarva, Delmarva Public Radio at WSTL 90.7 AM and WSCL 89.5 FM. Reminding you that we are about to have three interesting conversations coming up in the next half an hour. We start with John Echeverra, professor of law and acting director of the Environmental Law Center at Vermont Law School. He wrote an interesting piece in the New York Times, which I saw that is directly and indirectly connected to the future of food because it has to do with the future of our land. It is about a Supreme Court ruling that will revolutionize land use law that could really change the nature of many things that just went right under the radar for most of us. And John, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Well, it's good to be with you.
So, John, tell us about this. I try to pride myself on following the news and whatever SCOTUS does, but this one just sailed way under the radar. I didn't see it till I saw your editorial, your op-ed. So talk to us about what this is.
Well, it's understandable that it sailed under the radar because the court issued its opinion in this case on the same day that it issued its opinion in the Voting Rights Act case.
Yeah.
So that got all the attention. But notwithstanding that fact, it is an important case because it essentially shifts the balance of power between communities and developers in deciding what kinds of development can go forward and under what conditions in the community. And basically, it does that by expanding the notion that the community should bear the burden of proof, should have to prove to a court's satisfaction what kinds of terms and conditions can be imposed on development. And the reversal that the court accomplished is that traditionally the courts have approached these issues by saying it's up to our elected representatives to make these decisions, and the courts ought to defer to those judgments. And now the court has essentially reversed that and says, no, it's the responsibility of the public to prove what kinds of conditions are needed to protect the public.
So this ultimately, let's describe in further detail what this means, though, and reading a little bit of what you wrote that Justice Elena Kagan said in her dissent and some of the stuff I've read now since then, I've read your piece about what she had said, mm-hmm. and what she had written, is that what this really does is if a developer comes into a community and says, okay, here's this farmland, I'm going to develop it, and the community says, no, you have to have these certain have to leave a certain amount of acres for farming or to save this wetland or whatever that is, they could literally ignore it because the burden of proof to say it's going to hurt our community is on the community and not on the part of the developer.
Well, let me give you a more specific example.
Please. Okay.
That's close to that where this decision will have bite. What the court said is that when the government imposes so-called monetary exactions on a developer, requiring them to put money into a pool of funds that will support infrastructure development, sewer construction, road construction, or land preservation, the government has to prove that under a strict standard that those so-called monetary exactions are justified. So, for example, here in Vermont, we have a program and a policy whereby if a developer wants to get state approval for a major development and the development will result in the destruction of prime agricultural soils. We in Vermont require the developer to place funds in a pool of money that is then used to acquire agricultural land so they can be permanently protected. It's a kind of compensatory mitigation program designed to offset, to some degree, the loss of agricultural lands due to development. Now, that program has been unchallenged and unquestioned to date. Now, I hope and pray that the program will survive and that it can will not be struck down under this new precedent. But this new precedent certainly invites legal challenges to that kind of program and makes that kind of program far more vulnerable to legal challenges than it was just a week ago.
Well, but that's significant. I mean, when you think about as Justice Kagan wrote about, this is a hugely significant development. It's not the same as we talked about earlier, obviously, with voting rights in terms of maybe taking away the rights of millions of Americans of color, the right to vote, which will be a huge battle in the coming decade. But this is another battle. This is a battle for the land. This is a battle for the future of how our land and our cities and towns develop, especially because developers hold so much political sway because of the money they have.
I would also suggest that it has to do with the future of local democracy.
Right.
Local democracy is largely about the use and management of land, because land development and land protection and land management is one of the primary preoccupations of local government. And under our traditional view of things, the local officials, the local community, should have the primary say in determining how the community develops. And what this, as I say, what this decision does is it shifts the balance of power. It gives developers a bigger stick, and you know, this is to challenge local officials, threaten them with lawsuits, and gives them greater leverage in getting what they want without mitigating the effects of the development they propose to do.
Well, John Echeverra, I first want to thank you, Professor of Law and Acting Director of the Environmental Law Center at Vermont Law School, for coming on the program today, for writing this piece in the New York Times, which will be linking to A Legal Blow to Sustainable Development. I'm glad we could kind of help spread the word here in the Mid-Atlantic region, who may not read the New York Times, but they certainly can read this article now and hear what we're saying about this. And I appreciate you taking the time with us, John.
My great pleasure.
Talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Tom Philpott, who's a food and ag blogger for Mother Jones, co-founder of Maverick Farms in North Carolina, who wrote a really interesting piece in Mother Jones called Secret Trade Agreements Undo the Last Shreds of Food Safety. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA-FM in Baltimore and Delmarva Public Radio all over the Delmarva Peninsula. And I, of course, misquoted because I went too fast. It's the piece that Tom Philpott wrote for Mother Jones is called Did a Slave Process the Shrimp in Your Scampi? And Tom, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Tom, this is a little echo there. I was really not shocked, because I'm not shocked by anything these days. But it's something that I think people are not aware of, because it's so, you know, we all shrimp has now become the staple as opposed to being an item that you got sometimes.
Right.
So we expect it. We want our shrimp scampi. We want to stir fry our shrimp. We want to barbecue our shrimp. We just want our shrimp. But
that's right.
What's behind the shrimp? What do you mean a slave in the process of the shrimp?
Well, about 20, 25 years ago, when you bought shrimp in the United States, it was wild caught, you know, maybe from the Gulf of Mexico, maybe from the Atlantic coast, all up and down the Atlantic coast. There's shrimp in California, and it was a seasonal food, and there was only so much of it. If the fishing communities were going to fish it sustainably, then you could only take so much. And that was reflected in the price. So shrimp was kind of this, you know, pricey, special occasion, kind of fancy food. And it still has that reputation a little bit lingering, like, you know, the shrimp cocktail as kind of a,
right,
a splurge item. Well, in about the last 20 or 25 years, you've seen the dramatic rise of factory-style shrimp farms, mostly in Southeast Asia, also in South America. And the way that these farms worked, the general way they work is that you clear a mangrove forest along coastline. And this is a tragedy in and of itself because these forests are extremely biodiverse. They oftentimes have had communities living on them for generations and generations, sort of living off the income of the natural resource, harvesting, various kinds of seafood, maybe selling some of it for market, mostly living on it, and, you know, not really meddling with the ecosystems that much. With shrimp farming, what you do is you go in and literally clear cut it. And so you're wiping out massive amounts of biodiversity. You're also removing this livelihood from these communities and handing it over to a private landowner who owns a factory. And then you're producing, instead of all these different species together, one species that's shrimp. And whenever you go to one species like that, then you get all these kinds of disease problems, especially when you pack them pretty tightly together. You start to get disease pressures, pest pressures. And so the next thing you know, you're hitting them with pesticides and antibiotics and things like that. And, you know, they can only last so long before the water just gets so foul. And so oftentimes you'll see these shrimp farms just moving on and you know, leaving behind this sort of fetid, gross mess when they found, you know, this kind of vibrant, highly productive ecosystem. That's just the farming side. So besides farming it, it's also got to be, shelled and veined and frozen down, the various, processing part of the equation. And what it turns out is that in the countries where it's very well established, you know, predictably enough, the labor conditions have gotten pretty bad. You know, if you're going to produce enough shrimp, and now we now import, 80% of our shrimp. So if you go to a restaurant and order shrimp, unless it says, you know, wild-caught Gulf shrimp or wild-caught, you know,
wherever that's from,
coast of South Carolina shrimp or something, you're probably almost certainly getting farmed shrimp from one of these places.
So, but let me just interrupt for a moment, because I want to get to the point about Narong and the shrimp coming to America and Walmart and how they are not inspected and how literally slave labor is going into the shrimp that you make, but nobody really cares. Now this could change drastically with new laws taking place. Change drastically for the worse.
So there's this company in Thailand. So Thailand ends up being one of the centers of shrimp processing and shrimp production. And there's a major company in Thailand called Narong that, you know, buys shrimp from these various farms and processes it and sends it to the United States. And it was until very recently a major supplier to Walmart. And a couple of NGOs got together and interviewed some people at a Narong facility. And, you know, they found that they were largely migrant workers from Burma who were, claiming to them in these interviews to have been pretty much exploited, being charged exorbitant fees for their papers. That were often falsified papers, that that there were underage workers working on the shifts, and what the according to Thai law, you can't have kids under a certain age work at all. I think it's 15, and under 18 they can't, between 18 and 16 they can't work on the night shift, and what the company was doing, according to these interviews, was basically hiding its underage workers, and including some that were illegal, you know, illegal to work under any circumstances, on the night shift to avoid inspections. And, you know, I should say that there is, you know, because of these historic problems, there is this system of sort of industry-led inspections that goes on. There's a thing called the Best Aquacultural Practices Seal that is a group that Walmart and some of the other, you know, major buyers of shrimp organized. And it's not just for shrimp. It's for other other products. And this facility was certified by BAP.
But as you
Walmart, something interesting happened. So this report comes out, and you know, I start to write about it, and I called Walmart up and asked them for their reaction to it, because the report was accusing them of, you know, having bought a bunch of this shrimp, and I got an interesting response from them. They said that we stopped buying shrimp from Nerong in 2012, based on our own inspections. So we did an inspection ourselves. They wouldn't tell me what they found or when exactly this happened, but they claimed to have done an inspection and they stopped buying it in 2012. This is before this report came out. I mean, the report came out in May of 2013. And so I went back to the people who wrote the report and said, well, you know, look, you're accusing Walmart of buying the shrimp, and they're saying that they stopped based on their own inspection, and they handed over to me U.S. Trade Bureau documents showing that Walmart's name was on a bunch of shipments up to and including March of 2013, multiple shipments.
So
So basically Walmart was, you know, I'm not really sure what they were doing. So I took this information to Walmart and I said, look, you know, I'm looking here at documents that I'll share with you suggesting that you've been buying their shrimp all the way up until, you know, something like March or April of 2013.
I'm sorry to interrupt, because we're really out of time because we have the pre-recorded segment we have to jump into here.
Oh, okay.
But we'll come back to this. Tom Philpott, we're linking to his article, Did a Slave Process your Shrimp in Your Scampi. He's food and ag blogger for Mother Jones. And Tom, thanks so much. We'll come back to finish this up. Appreciate you being part of the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We conclude Soundbites with a visit to the 32nd Street Farmers Market in Baltimore to speak with members of the Farm Alliance of Baltimore City, a network of producers working to increase the viability of urban farming, improving access to urban-grown foods. Producer Stephanie Mavronis brings us this story.
Every Saturday morning at the 32nd Street Farmers Market in Baltimore, farmers and merchants from across the state of Maryland set up stands to sell their produce and products. One of the farm stands is unique, though, in that it sells vegetables, flowers, and honey from 11 farms and apiaries. The stand belongs to the Farm Alliance of Baltimore City, a network of urban farmers in Baltimore. Over 3 weekends, I visited the stand and spoke to the rotating crew of farmers staffing it, along with co-producer Mark Gunnery. The first person we spoke to was Maya Kosak, coordinator of the Farm Alliance and former OSI fellow. I asked her what exactly the Farm Alliance is.
So the Farm Alliance is a cooperative network of 11 different urban producers. And so everything from diversified vegetables to aquaponics to apiary, beekeeping. So a whole different range of producers, and we work together to sell, do joint sales, joint marketing, and share equipment and just try to make farming in the city more viable.
How long have y'all been together?
About a year and a half now. So this is our second full season together.
And how's it going?
It's going really well. We have continued our stand at the Saturday Waverly Market, which is doing really well. We just started doing some shared restaurant sales together. We've really put a lot of focus this season on food access through our neighborhood farm stands. So we're offering incentives to help people who receive nutrition benefits buy even more produce. And we're growing.
Why did you all decide to come together like this?
So the idea to come together as a network really grew out of existing collaborations. People were already talking to each other, going in on seed orders together, sharing some tools here and there. And there was really interest in doing something more intentional and sort of bigger scale in terms of working together. So it grew out of those collaborations. So there's currently 11 members in the Alliance. We started out last year with 8. And before the end of the season, we'll probably have one or two more join on. And it's a range of, some are nonprofit, some are for-profit, some are a mix in between. Everything from backyard scale up to 6-acre site.
And when you talk about getting equipment together, buying equipment, mm-hmm. What kind of equipment are you talking about?
So far we've, through our farm feast dinners with Kinderhook and Black Sauce, we've been able to raise funds towards some shared tools. So in general, we're talking about mid-range things that cost maybe between $200 and $600 that would be expensive for a startup farm, but still are reasonable to share. We're not sharing shovels because people need those frequently. But some agricultural tools like a broad fork, a seeder, a wheel hoe, and a mower, that kind of thing.
One of the farms that has been with the Alliance since it started is Real Food Farm. Real Food Farm is located in Clifton Park and is a project of Civic Works. We spoke to farm manager Tyler Brown and field manager Christy Ottinger. I asked Tyler how Real Food Farm got involved with the Farm Alliance.
We have been around for about 3.5 years, and we started talking with other farmers and sharing ideas and talking about, you know, how can we make our lives easier, and informally meeting. So we were kind of around at the beginning when the farmers just started to talk about, you know, how could we work together to make our lives a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. And how are you working together to make your lives easier?
So we do a lot of shared marketing and shared branding. We share spaces like Real Food Farm has a walk-in cooler that everyone brings the produce to then go to market. Because a lot of times smaller urban farms don't have the infrastructure to have their own walk-in cooler or other kind of things like that on the farm.
And how's it going being part of the Alliance?
It's been really cool. I really love having a communal stand together and sharing a lot of the tools and resources that we have. And it's really nice to have a community and figure a lot of things out together about how to navigate growing and selling in the city and, you know, figuring out who's going to grow what.
So do you all coordinate what you are going to be growing and selling?
To an extent. We all kind of grow what we like to grow and what we want to grow because we all have different markets. The Waverly stand isn't our only market, so a lot of us do CSAs and also go to other small markets around the city and in the county. So we all grow like the full range of things, but certain specialty items we'll chat about and figure out who wants to grow what.
What do you think of this model of farming and distribution?
I like it. I think it really works for such small producers like us. I mean, most of us are super tiny and we wouldn't have enough resources or even enough product necessarily to have a stand on our own and, you know, to look like a nice full display. And it's really great also for sharing the resources. So we have a communal tool shed that we share tools and have a checkout system like a library. So it really helps all around. And it's, like I said, it's really nice to have the community of support for, you know, other farmers. We can figure out what's going on if we all have issues or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Part of the Farm Alliance's mission is to expand access to quality, locally grown foods. One way they do this is to make it easier and more economical for people receiving food assistance like SNAP to buy their products and produce. Elisa Lane, farm manager for Whitelock Community Farm in Reservoir Hill, explains.
What's been really great this year is that through the Farm Alliance, we got some incentive money so that if people use their benefits, like EBT, SNAP, WIC, or FNMP vouchers, we actually have a double dollar program, so we're able to give people double the amount of produce for what they purchase. So people are getting very excited about that, and it's helping us get the produce to the people that we're trying to get it to.
One of the interesting projects represented at the Farm Alliance stand is the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future Aquaponics Project. David Love is the project director for the Public Health and Sustainable Aquaculture Project at the Center for a Livable Future and helps run the aquaponics project at Silburn Arboretum in northwest Baltimore. I asked him what they did at the project and what aquaponics is all about.
Aquaponics in general is a way for raising fish and crops together in the same system. We've got tilapia. We also have a bunch of greens that we're growing.
And how do you grow them together?
Oh, good question. So the tilapia we grow in fish tanks, of course, and we feed them fish feed. And that's the only input into the growing system. So the fish eat the feed, they make waste, and we use the plants to actually absorb the fish waste. And so the plants bioremediate the water, cleans the water, and it cleans, and then we've got a recirculating system, so the water flows throughout the whole system.
How long has the project been around?
So the project is run by the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and we've been going about 2 years and selling with the farmers market for about 6 months.
Do you sell your tilapia too?
We will be selling the tilapia soon. They're about a pound right now, which is close to what we want to sell them for.
How does this fit into Center for a Livable Future's mission?
Mm-hmm. Well, the center does a whole host of things related to farming and feeding people. And this is a sustainable agriculture model that involves protein, which is, there are vegetable proteins and there are, you know, animal proteins, and fish is not something that you typically see raised in Baltimore City. So we're adding to that. You know, you've got oysters from the bay, you've got wild fish caught in the ocean, but those are being depleted more and more. And so we need to start thinking about how we're going to be raising fish in tanks, aquaculture, to, you know, feed the world's population. This year actually is the first year that more fish have been raised on farms than have been caught in the ocean. So this is a really landmark year, and we're a part of that in a very, very small way.
That was David Love, Project Director for the Public Health and Sustainable Aquaculture Project at the Center for a Livable Future. He helps run the aquaponics project at Silbourne Arboretum in Northwest Baltimore. You also heard Christy Ottinger and Tyler Brown from Real Food Farm, Elisa Lane from Whitelock Community Farm, and Maya Kosak, coordinator of the Farm Alliance. Those are just some of the members of the Farm Alliance of Baltimore City. For a full list of farms and apiaries and more information, visit farmalliancebaltimore.org. And you can visit their stand every Saturday at the 32nd Street Farmers Market from 7 a.m. to noon at 32nd and Barclay Streets in the Waverly neighborhood in Baltimore. For Soundbites and The Mark Steiner Show, I'm Stephanie Mevronis.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.